from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
You may well call it myth, I think, but it's a kind of Herodotus knew, as later historians did not understand, that myth mattered, that what held those Spartans in place was the myth of freedom.
The principles.
And the principle. And so, right is his interpretation.
Welcome to Soundings, the life and work of the ancient Greek historian Herodotus. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guest is John Harrington of Duke University. John Harrington is the editor of a series of volumes on Greek and Roman authors published by Yale University Press. During his recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, John Harrington worked on a forthcoming book in the series about Herodotus. According to John Harrington, the histories of Herodotus are the first extended prose narratives in Western civilization. They are also our first political tracts. The histories were composed for oral delivery, and in their organization resemble the compositions of the epic poet Homer. Here is John Harrington.
Well, first, who he was. He was born in the southwest Asia Minor, a little Greek city, about 484 BC, and he died sometime after 430 BC. We don't know when exactly, but the last reference in his book is to events of 430. In between, he traveled. He traveled over most of the ancient world as it was then known. He traveled to Egypt while the civilization was still at its height. He saw Babylon while the ziggurat was still standing. He traveled northwards to Russia, into the Black Sea, studied the Scythians, as they were then called, on the southern steppes of Russia. He also traveled to the west, and he knows about places much beyond his traveling. He knows vaguely about the Gates of Hercules, the Straits of Gibraltar. He knows even about navigations round the coast of southern Africa. He's our one source for the Phoenicians who traveled round there.
It sounds like you're talking about the first jet setter, as it were, somebody who saw the world whole. Is it fair to say that...
That is dead right, and that is what my book is about, I think. Yes. I find it very hard to describe how exciting this is, because he has been to Egypt, not when Egypt was in ruins, but he's been there while the worshippers were crowding around the temples. He's talked to the priests in the great temples at Thebes.
Give me a couple of specifics. Reduce this to some concrete
Let me give you the most exciting specific that I know. We can go to Egypt now and we can look at the temples. But Herodotus describes, for instance, the great festival of lamps at Sais, lamps that died out 2,400 years ago. But on a given night for the great goddess at Sais in Egypt, every Egyptian lit a lamp, and the lamps burned all night round their houses, round the temple in Sais, and all over Egypt, Herodotus says. Now, it's a detail like that you can't pick up from the ruins. This man has walked and talked among these folk.
What did he do with this? Is he simply, for example, recording these notes for his own purposes? Did he have a sense of audience? What was he trying to communicate to whom?
Well, hold it right there, because here we come to one of the great interests of the whole story, I think. He traveled. He traveled a great deal, as I've said, and he gives us this insight into the ancient world, Near East as well as Greece, that we don't get from any other author. He has actually been at Delphi while all the treasures of Apollo's temple were still there, and he describes them, the gold, the marvelous statues, which have long ago have disappeared, and he knows about Apollo's oracle. Just from that point of view, if we could just let him rest like there, right there, he would be, I think, one of the most exciting of authors. I think it's a natural human question. What was it like to live so long ago? What was it like to travel wide open through with eyes wide open through the great civilizations of the East? Right there, that would make him an important author, I think. He's a kind of time machine for me. You can get back through him. But now we come to the big bit, because he certainly was making these travels and observations for a purpose. What he was eventually trying to do was to set the background for what to him was the great historical event of his time, or rather just before his time. That was the great war between the Persian Empire and the Greeks. During this time, Persians, as Hausmann says in his poem, the king with half the east at heel, came against tiny little disorganized Greece, and the Greeks won, and Europe remained European for that time. And so his whole history is homing in to what happens in the last two-thirds of his book, that is the account of the great attack on Greece by the Persian Empire, and really the climax comes at the great battles that we've all heard of in the history books. First, the Persian invasion at Marathon in 490 BC, beaten off by a miracle, and then 10 years later, the grand invasion, the invasion led by King Xerxes of Persia, with really half the east at heel, people from all over the shop, that invasion against the Greeks in 480 to 479 BC. That's where the epic has its culmination. But up to that time, he's been traveling around, setting the background, asking, what were these people like? What were the Greeks like? What were the Persians like? How did this great clash come about?
All right, give me some answers to those questions. We're looking at Herodotus to get a sense of the ancient world, and would you call him a military historian because he is noteworthy for this account?
No, he isn't. That's the surprising thing. He ends a military historian. Those last three books or so of the histories are the prototype of much later military and political history, right down almost to the 20th century. We've chosen, quite wrongly, as we now see, to regard history as simply military and political events concerning nations. And in the end, Herodotus' book homed into that. It culminates in that great, in those great expeditions.
But he also gives us a sense of social history.
That's right.
Everyday life.
While he was getting on the way there, he saw not only the social life, but he saw the very geological background. He begins from the bottom upwards. Rivers, he describes. He loves rivers, rivers that divide nations, and streams. But his account of the Valley of the Nile is one of the first great geological accounts of anything.
Well, I don't know if this is a fair comparison, John, but it reminds me of the novels of James Michener, giving one's readers a marvelous panoramic sense.
You're quite right, but it took us 2,400 years pretty well to get back there. That is the surprise and the excitement. He didn't know he was a historian. He ended a historian. He ended with the title that Cicero gave him,
namely,
400 years later, Father of History. But to get there, he tried to see everything. I mean, what you get from the histories is not only a landscape, the very geology of it, but also the dreams and beliefs of the people who move across the landscape. But now, to come back to your question as to how it added up for Herodotus, what Herodotus thought he's doing. What I'd like to do is to translate just straight out of the Greek, perhaps with some stumblings, the opening sentence of the histories.
All right, let's hear it.
A monumental sentence. It goes like this. This is the publication of the research, historia, that means research or inquiry. Later it came to mean history. This is the publication of the research of Herodotus of Halicarnassus, that's his hometown, in order that neither the things that came about through human beings should grow faint because of time, nor the great deeds, the great and marvelous deeds, some performed by the barbarians, some performed by the Greeks, others performed by the barbarians. Barbarians simply means non-Greeks at this date. There's a long semantic story behind that. That in order that those deeds should not be without their glory, but especially, he was inquiring, through what cause they fought one another.
Let's stop on that. Let's pause on causes and politics and ideologies in the ancient world. How do you sort this or unsort this tangle when you look at the histories of Herodotus?
Well, when you look at the histories as a whole, you see, I think what I've already been saying, that to him, a cause went as far back as mountains and rivers and national customs, national beliefs. All these added into the fabric of history. And as he goes through his earlier books, he shows the Persians gradually getting prouder and prouder, more and more anxious to rule the world, and explains how they gathered the world in under the Persian empire, and then how they were poised against Greece.
Let's stop on, again on this, John Harrington. We're talking about the histories of Herodotus. Does this mean that he is writing, I don't mean in the sense of ethics or religion, but that he is writing a moral history, that he's bringing what, a preconception, a thesis to his view of events, or is he simply reporting them? Is he our first journalist? Is there a middle ground there between the two?
Half and half. That's what makes him the most puzzling and wonderful of authors, I think. He had a very clear eye for fact. He would have been a superb journalist. The best example of that is in the first half of his book four, where he describes the customs of the Scythians, as the people who inhabited the plains of Russia, describes the great royal burials, describes how they smoked cannabis and got and went wild, describes so many things that nobody would believe.
Early National Geographic.
Exactly. Early National Geographic. He described them in such terms as nobody would believe him for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. He said, for instance, in the Dnieper, which for him was the Borysthenes, there are great fish which have no backbones. A likely story, but of course the sturgeon, from which we get caviar, the sturgeon doesn't really have a backbone. It has a gristly contrivance, but is not really a vertebrate.
So he was right.
He was right, but only centuries after that, only really since about 1800, when the Russians began to come into the picture and to excavate for themselves, do we realize how amazingly accurate was his account of the Scythians.
Well, let's come back to this business of causes and historical forces. Characterize for me what at least two sides of the Greek and the Peloponnesian encounter and the way Herodotus tells us about that. Are we talking, for example, roughly analogously to Republicans and Democrats, Marxists and capitalists? How does he divide the camps up, and how does he assign causes and forces to these two sides of the conflict?
Oh my, there's such a lot in that. Let me start from what I think is the central fact that he sees in this great clash between Europe and Asia, because so he does see it. He sees it right the way through also as a clash between despotism and freedom. He even sees it as an example of the virtues of the democratic life.
All right, now
the
he's putting the Greeks on. The Greeks are the good guys.
Well, not quite. Their principles are good. The principles for which they fight are indeed good. But he records things with a wonderful impartiality most of the time. You remember that first sentence from his histories. The great and marvelous deeds shown both by the Greeks and by the barbarians. He's still at a time when impartiality is possible, but he does see certain principles clashing, and he knows very well which is right and which is wrong.
How does he make that decision, John? Is that something subjective to him, or has history borne him out, so to speak?
I don't know. How can one tell? Could I read you another passage from him where I think this comes out, or two passages where this this idea comes out as clearly as it does anywhere. A discussion in book three where he's talking about, or rather he's making Persians talk about the three possibilities of government. This in some sense, by the way, is the first tract on politics in the history of our civilization. But one of the Persians, unbelievably, supports democracy, and the Persian talks about the loveliest word of all, isonomia. Isonomia means freedom, equality before the law. And again, when there's a moment when the exiled Spartan king is talking to King Xerxes, he's an exile, he's with Xerxes' army, and Xerxes says to him, "Look, how do you Greeks, how can you possibly fight against my forces? Don't you see that I have all these troops from everywhere, from Afghanistan, from Egypt, from Ethiopia, and I lash them into battle, as indeed he did? How can you stand against them?" This is at Thermopylae. And the Spartan answers in these words, "The Spartans, free as they are yet not free in everything. They too have a master, the law. And before him, they cringe far more even than your slaves cringe before you."
So we are beginning to see a shift here between, as you said, the reign of the tyrant and the reign of law.
Right, and also the reign of democracy. He's not too sure about democracy, but one thing he does know, that gets things done. And whether this is right or not, who can tell? But what followed that conversation with the Spartan king and Xerxes was the Battle of Thermopylae, in which 300 Spartans held off those forces. In the end, they died, it's true, held off those forces for days and days.
Is this what we should call myth, John Harrington, or should we call it history? We're mixing here facts and circumstances.
We're mixing here, let's say, facts and interpretation, mm-hmm. and we should really come later to that entire question of interpretation. You may well call it myth, I think, but it's a kind of Herodotus knew, as later historians did not understand, that myth mattered, that what held those Spartans in place was the myth of freedom.
The principles.
The principle. And so, right, it is interpretation.
All right.
It's not just interpretation, I think.
Let's talk about that. How, for example, does Herodotus influence the doing of history? Now, there's an enormous question. We have schools of history, and we have thousands of historians intervening between us and Herodotus himself. But if, as you say, Cicero called him the father of history, tease some of those threads out for me.
Well, let's go back to that question of interpretation. What makes him very largely different from most historians until, at any rate, the 19th century, is the fact, as you so rightly said, he does interpret the pattern. There is a pattern against which he sees the whole of life. And it's here that we enter into a dimension of him which is both hard for us to understand and also, I think, is supremely beautiful. For whatever reason he imposes or he sees in the events of the Persian Wars a pattern very like that the Attic tragedians in his own time, that Sophocles particularly, saw in human life. In this dimension of Herodotus, indeed, the Persian Wars is a giant tragedy. Mm-hmm. And with tragic interpretations, almost with some of the speeches have the effect of tragic choruses. Now, could I read you again another passage?
Let's hear it.
In which this comes out most clearly. That comes out throughout the very structure of his history. This is at the point at the beginning of Book 7, where Xerxes is meditating the great expedition against Greece, and all his advisors agree with him, except one, the wise old uncle named Artabanos, who pronounces to Xerxes the rule against which life works. And this is an extract from Artabanos' speech, trying to persuade Xerxes not to go. "You see how God strikes the overlarge animals with his lightning and does not allow them to show off, whereas little creatures don't even tickle him." There's a certain quaintness. "You see how God always shoots his missiles down on the highest buildings and the highest trees, for it is God's habit to chop back all things that are over large."
So Xerxes is being warned here.
Xerxes is being warned that the Persian Empire is too great, that it cannot control itself, that it is being watched by the gods and it must fail. And as Herodotus interprets it, that is what happened. Now here we're up against not just Herodotus' histories, but against life and politics to this day. We in our own time have seen states that grew too great. I would think Hitler's invasion of Russia or Napoleon's invasions of Russia are supreme examples of this. And could I digress here to tell you something that is always in my mind when I read Herodotus and when I hear criticisms of this kind of interpretation of life? Go back to that wonderful fourth book, The Account of the Scythians. Herodotus describes, above all, the great plains, the endless cold of Scythia. The Scythian habit, which he says is the wisest of all, not of staying in any one place, but when an army comes in, fleeing before it, scattering, destroying the grain supplies, fleeing inwards into the landmass. Now, hang on to that.
All right.
Just hold it right there, and then remember the account of what we know about Hitler's decision to invade Russia in 1941. Was it not against the advice of his generals?
Succumb to the same sort of warning.
What has happened? Once again, a combination of geography and human pride of someone getting too great. So I think, although it may be called naive, and in many ways it is a naive view, yet it does hit some deep truths that we would do well, even in the 20th century, not to forget.
John Harrington, we're talking about your investigations into the histories of Herodotus. Let's conclude our conversation. How should we read him today? Who should read him today? You have described his importance. You've outlined his function as an historian. But bring him into the 1980s. Is that possible? And present him to people who are not familiar with him or who know his name only remotely?
That's exactly what I would like to do. I'm writing this little book as part of a series which is designed to do just that. There's no pretentiousness, I hope, about it. The idea is, because I and my fellow writers believe that these people still have things worthy of our thought, we would like to bring the modern reader, who may have no background at all in these matters, to bring him up to a position where he can confront these authors at first sight so strange, at closer acquaintance so close to us, because they're also human beings who have lived and written in a remote time. It's like taking, as I feel, the way astronomers get the distance of a star by taking bearings from two very distant parts of the orbit. You can sit there in your own time and stew in your own juice, or you can have a binocular vision. You can look at life through the telescope of Herodotus, and I think, the faith is anyway, that you'll come out a richer person. All that, I think, is to be found in Herodotus. I'd like to mention one or two issues, though, that seem to me raised by him and still quite contemporary.
What would
issues.
They be?
I think the main one is his sense that permeates the history, that what he's talking about is a crucial moment in East-West relations. He's talking about the time when the real hatreds formed between the nations of Europe and the nations of the East. He himself, who was born on the borderline, actually, Halicarnassus was in the Persian Empire when he was born, he himself has a wonderful impartiality so often in these matters. But what he sees happening, and he knows it, he sees this invasion as a step in an eternal historical pendulum, or a swing in an eternal historical pendulum, the enmity, the warfare between East and West. Interestingly enough, he sees the Persian invasion as a kind of retaliation of the Trojan War, of all things. when Europe invaded a town in the coast of Asia, and did great injustice, Herodotus sees the Persians as retaliation. Asia comes back into Europe, and then, I mean, one can go on. I think it at once becomes plain. One looks forward to Alexander the Great's revenge attack on Persia, forward to the Crusades, forward, and I don't think it's absolutely irrelevant, forward to our own day. That great clash mm-hmm. continues, and it may be that we shall learn by looking into earlier phases of it.
John, quickly, let's conclude our conversation. You've got one more passage there to read from the historian Herodotus.
Yes, I have, and it brings out a point that I think is worth making, something that makes Herodotus worth reading. In modern life particularly, we get caught up with the present moment. It is so hard to see the scheme of things as a whole, to see the magnificence and the tragedy of life. Herodotus does see that. He's never unconscious of it. And I find it helps to come back to him, not only for his wit and his humor and the sense that you're gradually acquiring a friend, but also for a sense of perspective. I'd just like to read one quote which I think moves everybody who reaches it. It's at the height of King Xerxes' power. He's reached the Hellespont. He's about to bring his ships and men across into Europe. And there's a grand review held. The beaches of the Asiatic coast are crowded with his men. The ships fill the strait so that you can hardly see the water of the Hellespont. And this is what Herodotus says, and it's the kind of shock that he occasionally gives you. "And as Xerxes looked upon the entire Hellespont covered by ships, and all the beaches and the plains of Abydos packed with men, at that moment he first congratulated himself on his great fortune, and then he burst into weeping." And the wise advisor asks him, "Why are you bursting into weeping? This is the greatest moment of all." And he says, "Suddenly, while I looked, I realized that in 100 years, not one of these people would be alive."
John Harrington is a professor at Duke University. He's the editor of a series of volumes on Greek and Roman authors published by Yale University Press. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, John Harrington worked on a forthcoming book in the series about the ancient Greek historian Herodotus. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on the Life and Work of Herodotus, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the giving and receiving of gifts. My guests will be Lewis Hyde of Harvard University and Ronald Sharp of Kenyon College. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The life and work of the ancient Greek Herodotus, whom Cicero called the father of history. This week on Soundings, John Harrington of Duke University discusses his forthcoming study of Herodotus, whose histories comprise the first prose narratives and the first political tracts in Western civilization. Herodotus Then and Now. This week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center, on this station.